Welcome back to the Diary of a CFO podcast, the podcast where finance leaders share the lessons, challenges, and wins that shape their careers as well as their organizations. I'm your host, Wasia Kamon, and today I'm so delighted to have with me Christina Ross. She's a serial CFO turned founder and CEO of Cube, a no-code FP&A platform for modern finance teams. Christina is a two-decade finance veteran from startup through public companies and a former finance transformation leader at Deloitte Consulting, managing large-scale technology projects for the office of the CFO. After growing frustrated with the manual nature of FP&A, we've all been there, and after an implementation of a leading solution gone wrong, Christina set out to build the next generation of FP&A technology, and she founded Cube in 2018. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you. I'm very impressed because one, we've been so frustrated with how manual FP&A is, but you did something about it. So very curious to hear about your career journey. What drew you into finance in the first place? And did you ever picture yourself as a CFO or a CEO?
Thank you. And great question. I definitely started out my finance career not thinking I wanted to be in finance. I knew that I wanted to be in the world of business. So When I went to school, I was a business major. I studied operations management, which is like a mix between industrial engineering and the real world. And think about process, supply chain, all of those things. I love seeing how things work. And this is really nerding out. I was a member of the American Production Inventory Control Society. So that gives you a sense of how much I loved manufacturing in that entire space. But really, I wanted to understand the world of business. And to understand business, you have to understand the numbers. And the reality was not everyone speaks the numbers. And that's still a challenge for finance leaders today is how do we translate this language that we speak to others who don't speak it? So I felt that if I ever wanted to be in business, work for a business, run my own business one day, I had to become an expert in the numbers. And more importantly, I had to learn how to speak this very specific language. So that's how I got into finance to begin with. And I started out in the early 2000s, back when GE was considered, you know, the Google or Amazon or Apple of its time. Yes, that was a long time ago now, but I joined working in their finance team and moved around the world in different types of finance roles. So I got to see it from a number of different angles, see where it was different in different industries and different types of businesses and where it was similar. And it was really, really awesome work for someone in their early 20s. You get to travel the world, you work a million hours a week, which in those days just, you know, was something that helped me to learn a lot faster. And then I moved over to Deloitte Consulting and did finance transformation work. And that's a very fancy way of saying we supported these large scale system implementations, which if you've ever been through these, especially at enterprise companies, you know, it's not just about the software. It's really about just like everything in this world, it's all about the people. And so it's about training. It's about mapping out how people use software. What are the jobs to be done? How do you trace this across different teams and geographies and regions and help do these large scale rollouts and deployments? So I did that with Deloitte for about 3.5 years. And then I was ready to run my own finance team. And I got lucky quite a few times. I joined some amazing companies, 2 out of 3 of which went public. And I joined them in the very early days. So the first one was this little 50-person company that I joined called Rent the Runway. And of course, it's now a public company and it's been around for quite a few years. For all of the listeners wondering, yes, I did get free clothes to wear and borrow. It was definitely one of the perks of the job. But I learned the world of early stage finance at the time. So I went from very large scale enterprise to as early as it comes and understanding how to fundraise. And you know, I tell a lot of stories from these days around how it wasn't my job to just roll up the numbers. I had to buy the soap as well for the bathroom. After Rent the Runway, I went to this company called Criteo, also, again, a publicly traded company. I was there for about 2 years where I met my husband, which is exactly why I left the company. Definitely don't want to work around your spouse for too long. And then joined another company called iView. We got to see another 10x growth journey. And then it was there, and this is probably the more interesting part of the story, where I became frustrated with what I think so much of the market and so much of the finance world is still challenged by today. And that is the following. We live in a world of really bad options, or at least we did when it comes to financial planning and analysis. And those two bad options really are, you could stick with your spreadsheets forever, And there's lots to be frustrated about. They don't scale. They're not databases. They have limited collaboration functionality, especially with Excel, which, you know, most finance professionals find superior to Google Sheets, except for the collaboration functionality. There's so much to love there, but so much that doesn't work. It doesn't scale. And then on the other hand, you have, I would call it traditional legacy platforms or point solutions that sit in the second category, which is really like very scalable technology, but very difficult to use, very difficult to learn and to adopt and to implement. And really, you're replacing your spreadsheet. So on the one hand, you have what you know and what you understand and what you've effectively built a language on top of. Excel and spreadsheets are the lingua franca of finance. But then on the other hand, you finally get the power and scalability, but you have to relearn effectively how to do FP&A. So harking back to those days in doing finance transformation, it's not just about the software. You have to change how you run your operations, how you what people are using the software, how they use it, et cetera. So these tale of two bad options basically left me in a very difficult situation where I finally decided to go for option number two. I was a technical person. I implemented a leading solution. They told me it'd be, you know, 6 weeks. 6 months later, I was still mid-implementation and realizing that I couldn't get my numbers out. And my team didn't want to use the platform and they wanted to go back to Excel and they built a backup model in Excel, which again defeats the purpose. And my board and my leadership team told me, quote, I'm not logging into that thing, but you can send me a spreadsheet. And I realized very quickly that spreadsheets aren't going anywhere. And so why fight it? And instead develop the first fully spreadsheet native FP&A platform. And what that means is we built an entire backend that connects seamlessly to everywhere you work, because it's really FP&A is not just about financial planning and analysis. It's about harnessing the collective intelligence of the organization. So that means, can you capture it? It lives in people's heads. It doesn't live in a source system. That's the crazy thing about planning. It really does become your system of record. So you have to capture that information and you also have to share it back with people. And so the best way to do it is where people work. And so Cube has this really integrated, powerful data engine, calculation engine, but it connects to all the different areas where you work. So that's Excel, that's Google Sheets, that's Slack, that's Teams, and then coming soon, of course, is PowerPoint and slides. So all the ways people work. So that's a little bit about me, how I got my start and why I'm so passionate about FP&A and why I'm so passionate about finance and about how making it a better, how we'd love to make it a better place, not just for finance professionals, but for all of their organizations.
That is so empowering and inspiring too, because you saw something was broken, actually did not exist, and you turn into something to where it is today. So what would you say helped you in that transition, right? Because it's something to see something and you want to change it, but actually doing something about it is quite different. So what would you say are some of the things that helped you, especially coming from, I think you were CFO and then you went into being a founder?
Well, I think the best thing, I'm going to talk a lot about people in this session, is my village of folks who I know who are in finance to validate the idea. Because it's one thing to have an idea. It's another thing to start taking action on it. So I'm sure for listeners out there who have a really great idea, who are inspired by something and want to start a company, I'll tell you, I spoke to endless number of people who said, I have this idea and I really want to do something about it. And only so many people in my network who actually went and started a company. And the reason I share this is because it's really not that hard to take the next leap, but it does take a lot of blind faith and a huge amount of risk. So I'll tell you, my first step was realizing that this was something that I wanted in my life. So it's not just about the idea. So many of us have so many brilliant ideas that we want to take action on. For me, it was really a personal decision of, am I willing to take the risks that go along with starting a company, which really means taking your income down to zero. So if you're working in finance today and you're employed, like that means that you're going to go intentionally to zero. And maybe if you're not employed, now is a great time to start thinking about what's next in the future of finance. So I would say that that was maybe unexpectedly the biggest decision that I had to make. And then I started to create small milestones for myself. So I always reference the book, or I didn't read the book, I watched the movie, Moneyball. Which is, it's, you know, if the goal is to win the World Series, you really want to just focus on getting on base, You want to do one small thing at a time. And for me in the early days, it was figuring out who I was selling to. When I was building this FP&A platform, I thought it was going to be exclusively for small businesses. And I started talking to small business leaders who I knew, folks in my network, and I started to understand they didn't look at finance the exact same way that you would in a larger company. And larger, I just mean mid-market. It could be 50, 100, 250, 500 employees. But if you're a mom and pop shop, I mean, I remember very distinctly one of the answers someone in my network gave me was like, I was like, how do you think about cash flow? And he's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, cash flow, like, how do you plan on what you're going to spend? And how do you think about receivables and payables? He's like, sorry, Christina, I'm confused. We have money, we spend it, we don't spend it. What do you mean? And not, certainly not all small businesses are like that, but it was a little bit less of a FP&A focus. That helped me figure out who my customer was, and I built a product for that market.
That is awesome, because now your platform pretty much can work in different size of companies. So what would you say for your own experience working with small business versus larger companies, especially when you're trying to go in that stage where you're trying to go public? What is something people often miss in that period when it comes to the importance of FP&A?
I mean, even understanding that it is probably the most important, critical, and strategic function within an organization. And I think anyone who's been through early stage finance organization has seen this. There's usually a track that where companies hire finance. So it starts with the most basic and the most important, which is like, we need someone to pay our taxes. Like, they may be doing bookkeeping through a register, but at the end of the day, you got to pay your taxes. So they hire a CPA or they hire a bookkeeper. That's step one. As businesses get a little bit larger, they hire a full-time accountant, they'll get QuickBooks or Xero, and they start to build. Again, that's finance, is like, we just need to keep track of the comings and goings of expenses. Mm-hmm. Then as businesses start to get a little bit larger, and maybe the founder or the CEO can no longer manage it with just the accountant or a small bookkeeping team, that's when FP&A usually starts to become really relevant. And we tend to see that generally around the time a company hits somewhere between 50 and 100 FTEs. So usually 100 is around the marker where FP&A starts becoming more and more relevant. And usually by 200 employees, most companies have a head of FP&A. Maybe that head of FP&A is titled VP of Finance. Maybe it's their CFO. But there is a leader whose job is wholly focused on managing not just what happened in the past, but what will happen in the future.
Okay. And then in that moment when the company is growing, what would you say are some things that as finance leaders, we should pay attention to, right? Because the things that matters when you a smaller company are different from when you mid-size versus a growing company. And you've worked in all three. So I'm very curious to hear, what have you learned in those different stages?
I go back to the famous song, Mo Money, Mo Problems. It's just as things become bigger, the scale becomes more complex. So in the early stage days, it's more like, it's more of setting up a foundation culturally in an organization of why managing to the numbers. I'm going to sound, it sounds very rudimentary, but I've seen it a million times. Why managing to the numbers is critical. I'm talking early stage at this point. So sub 100 FTEs. Oftentimes, remember, these organizations have come up over time, maybe haven't been as focused on the financials. They've been focused on building a business through sheer will, through great sales and marketing, through customer focus, et cetera. So trying to establish a culture and a foundation that finance is important and here's why. And oftentimes the role of the finance professional is to help teach and communicate to the rest of the organization why it's such a critical function and why they need to pay attention to it and how it ultimately serves them. So that I found in the very early stages is critical. As you start to become a larger company, it's about setting up all your people process operations again. You need more than just a bookkeeper. You need a strategic finance person, whether it's manager, VP, C-level person, focused on the future and planning. And that's really critical. Finally, as companies start to get bigger, you start to see planning cycles move from once a year, twice a year to being constant. I don't mean just forecasting. Typically in most organizations, we all have our Excel models or our models somewhere that we're just updating real life changes as they happen. That is a version of forecasting, but I'm more referring to formalizing forecasting throughout an organization. So it goes from having a once or twice a year budget to having that, plus having then a quarterly forecast, then having a monthly forecast, then having a real-time forecast. That's what we usually start to see as you become larger and larger in terms of organizations. It's just that planning maturity.
And in terms of planning maturity, I like how you said first you start with, you know, learning the basics of the numbers, and then you turn into strategic finance. What would be your best definition of what strategic finance is? Because when you come through college and finance, you know, accounting is just accounting, or finance is just this number, but you're not thinking strategically necessarily. So how do you grow into that and get into really what strategic finance is about?
The way that we define strategic finance is powering strategic business decisions with financial clarity. It's kind of a buzzword now, strategic finance, and you see a lot of even job definitions changing, I think rightly so, from FP&A or finance manager to strategic finance business partner. And I think it really reflects the world understanding the role of the finance professional. We have a framework at Cube that we use to think about how to become more strategic and what is strategic finance. You can get it on our website, and we call it the strategic finance hierarchy of needs. Okay. So if you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the idea is before you can achieve self-realization, self-actualization, you first need to have food and water. And you need to have, you know, a home and all of those things. The equivalent in finance is at the top of the pyramid, or at the top of the mountain, is being strategic. So driving alignment, decision-making, et cetera. But before you get there, I'm going to send shivers down everyone's spine. The data has to be right. There's four layers to the pyramid. And the bottom layer is data management, or data fidelity, or data integrity. And that is making data usable and trustworthy, so that we can then make strategic decisions. So first you need your data clean. And most folks, when they come to Cube, are struggling with this as anyone would. It is not just a finance challenge, but I'll also describe what makes this challenging for finance professionals, more so than I would argue anyone else in the business. Finance is the most downstream function in an organization. And what I mean by that is, if you think at the top of the org, if you think about a data structure, everything that happens in the business gets captured somewhere. There's a data capture in your CRM. There's data captured in your ERP. There's data captured in your HRIS platform. All that information then needs to be transformed and centralized in a way and translated so that finance can report at the end of the month, quarter, period, et cetera. And finance is the last stop before that data hits executives and leadership, or goes external and goes to Wall Street or to a board of directors. Last touch means finance is dealing with every single mistake, issue, data imperfection that happens in the organization. And by the way, we're the ones who sign off our name, or that we go to jail if it's wrong, like CFOs. Yes. So it is a big deal. And so again, think a broad lower layer of the pyramid is data management. The next layer is reporting and analysis. So now you've got the data right. Yes, I can finally do something with it. And that's translating numbers into actionable insights. So now I can say I have my numbers. Reporting is not just about putting it into a report. Reporting is about figuring out what that story is behind the numbers. Reporting is oftentimes about getting your data now into a format where you could then perform more analysis. So now we're getting more and more into the parts of the job that I know I love, and I know CFOs and finance professionals I speak with actually enjoy doing. Very few folks love the data management piece. So now we're on the second layer. Great. Now I have the reports that I need. I've analyzed the data. What's next? Reporting is typically in the past. Next comes planning and modeling. That's looking at the future. That's the next layer. That's about keeping plans current and connected to reality. One of my favorite sayings, or one of my famous sayings, is if we were great forecasters in finance, we wouldn't be doing this job. We'd be in Vegas betting on horses or basketball teams or something. It's not about perfect prediction. What it is about is understanding the drivers of your business. And when the world turns and the unexpected happens, that we're prepared to make changes in real time. That's really the power of planning. So again, the frequency of planning, the quality of your inputs, the quality of your model really matters. Now you have these three layers. Think of them like Lego blocks, or think of them like layers of the pyramid. Now you can finally ladder up and drive alignment and decision making. So that's how we think about what is strategic finance and how to get there. And I'm sure most of the listeners would be like, wait a minute, I do that and I don't have all these things perfect. That's okay. But typically, if you're going to sit in front of an executive and they're going to ask you, hey, what's, you know, even what happened last month, you're going to use all those layers. Number one, you got to have clean data. Number two, you have to pull a report together to look at the information and analyze it. Number three, you have to have a plan of which you're comparing against. So you can say, hey, we grew 20% last month. That could be the most amazing thing in the world, or that could be absolutely terrible, depending on what your plan said you were supposed to do. So there's the planning component. And then the why and the so what becomes the strategic finance. So as we think about how to be more strategic, thinking about checking a box on each of those really important layers.
Oh, I love that pyramid. I love how you explained it. And I definitely want to spend time at the bottom, right?
Yes.
When you said it, I was like, oh, I feel this. To get the data clean, like you said, because the data lives in so many different systems. So if you're using Salesforce, you know that you have regular field and 10,000 custom fields. And then you go into your HR and you have regular fields and 10,000 fields, and we call them differently. So that's where I think business partnering comes into place, and you have to work well with your accounting team. You have to work with different partners. So what do you advise people to do at that stage when you come in and you realize, ouch, I have a data integrity problem, or I have difficult relations with other departments because I need their data by X date in order to do my report, but they have their own struggles. Like, how do you navigate that kind of stuff?
I mean, we could do a whole session on just this one. So maybe next time we could do an hour on it, or a half an hour. There's a few different, if you think of it in a framework, which I love my frameworks, there's people, process, and technology. So going back to the consulting days, I can talk about each one of those. But let's also break down how to get to good data management. And we think of it like combining, cleaning, and controlling the data. The most important piece is having good data governance as a foundational layer. So this is probably like, maybe it's a little yawnable, but you need to have good data governance before you can know that your data is going to be right. And you brought up a really important part, which is how do I work with my accounting team, or how do I work with my sales team to have good data? At the end of the day, this goes back to a really important part about data integrity, which is the point of capture. So number one, we need to set the right sort of governance around making sure, I'll use the classic examples, did salespeople accurately put information in Salesforce? Yes. There's a lot of work to be done around that. And at the end of the day, it will not be perfect ever. I've never seen an organization be like, oh my gosh, our salespeople are the best. They do everything as they're supposed to, and they put the data into Salesforce. So we have to think of it in two ways. Number one, what is the sort of overall data governance and expectations that we're setting to make sure that data is clean and captured properly? That will include a control process. So as finance professionals, this is part of our jurisdiction, is to say, okay, if data is going to get cleanly into Salesforce at the end of the month, what controls are we giving back to finance, or whoever maybe is RevOps, or who their sales leader is? Maybe it's part of their commission plan to make sure that that data is captured appropriately. So that's part one. Part two is assuming it's going to be wrong. So that's where the data cleansing process comes in. And going back to like a very common example, I think we've seen over time, the trying to match up vendors or things like, there's Walmart.com, there's Walmart, there's Wal-Mart, there's data that's spelled different ways. Yes, you're rolling your eyes. We've all been there. We spent way too many hours, then we get a new file and it looks a little bit different, and you have to match these things. You know, so we talked about people in this, we talked a little bit about process and controls, and then we talk about technology. And as much as I'd love to make this a full pitch for Cube, and of course, this is one of the things that we do best, there are a number of different types of technology to help you cleanse your data, whether it's through, you know, at a most basic level, doing it in Excel and capturing all these different spellings and creating mapping tables, all the way through buying technology to cleanse these. This, by the way, is where I think AI is going to become very interesting. And we're starting to see the beginnings of this, because taking a step, a little bit of a side to this, automation is extremely precise and works very well, but you have to program it. So automation is you saying Walmart is the same as Wal-Mart, which is the same as Walmart.com. Intelligence starts to find these patterns over time and is saying Walmart without you having to program it, is saying these three things are the same. So that's where artificial intelligence and these LLMs are going to get a lot smarter over time around matching different data sets and handing them to you saying, do you agree that these are a match? That's where our job is going to get a lot more fun over time. And we're going to start to see more and more of the early layers of the pyramid become automated and start to see us be able to spend more time on the upper layers of the pyramid.
The dream. Yes. The dream.
Yes.
Now, going to the second layer in terms of reporting. So what I realized is sometimes, especially when you fresh in finance, your reporting is often based on what you understand, what makes sense to you, when reporting is for really your customers, whether internal, external. So what would you say, especially for the next generation of leaders, how can you accelerate learning? What kind of reporting works for who? And how can you really be a better storyteller? How can you really make your reporting come alive and be useful?
I love these questions. This is like the foundation of good strategic finance business partnering. And we've done this a number of different ways, but I think the first best, I'll just go in like very specific examples. The first one is when you're meeting with your executives, department leads, et cetera, I always recommend that you come with something. Because if you sit down generally with a marketing leader, you're going to get a sense of, they're going to tell you what they like to measure. So they'll come in with the same perspective that you're coming in with. Like, here's what I think you should measure. And they're going to say, here's what I think I should measure. Set up a listening tour. Come to the table prepared with something. However, have a look at what they like to measure and how they're measuring their business. But it also goes up a step further, which is like, what are your goals as a marketing organization? And almost, what is your mission as a marketing organization? So I like to start all the way at the top. Nice. And we have something we use internally at Cube for all of our departments is we have every single month we review the same sort of document, and it starts for each department that's presenting the department mission. Because these things, believe it or not, do change over time. Maybe a marketing team is really focused on getting leads and bringing new business in the door. Maybe a marketing team is more focused on brand. Maybe a marketing team is focused on launching campaigns. Each one of those things will determine what type of goals they have. So that might change what KPIs they're looking at, depending on what their mission is for that particular team. So number one, start out with the mission of the organization. Once that department leader has told you, here's what I'm focused on, you already have your list that you've come with, and you can start to merge those lists together to figure out what's most important. This is the part where most organizations run into challenges. There's a very big difference between KPIs and reporting.
Oh, Lord.
Yes.
Yeah, let's walk right here.
Yeah, let's start with this one. Anything more than five is a report. Any more than five metrics is a report. You can have three. I like one, because then you know if you're really on track. But you have to go through this uncomfortable forcing exercise of stack ranking. If I'm only going to pick three of these or five of these to review every single month with you, every single quarter, what are they? And then you can keep the rest, you know, maybe it's in another tab, another report somewhere. But the second you get more into more than three to five metrics, it's a report. So I always like to figure out what are the most high level ones that sort of capture all that data behind it. That's the second piece. And then you have your reporting. And typically, then you're able to have real strategic conversations where you're looking at those metrics and you can double click on them if they're working or not working. So then that goes back to what was the plan and what was the actuals. Very simple red, yellow, greens. Are we on track? Are we not? If red scares you, use Harvey balls. Throw back to Harvey balls. Those are great. But if you're on track or not on track, then you can use it to double click into your broader set of reporting and analysis. But going back again, it really is a team building motion. And you can use this as an opportunity to let that other executive know that I'm on your side. I'm here to listen to you to understand what are the metrics that are most important to you. What are you being driven by? How are you being ranked and scored? You can also figure out through this if there is a mismatch in terms of their incentives and alignment and what the organization is looking for. So again, let's use that marketing example, a classic one, as I've seen lots of marketers are, you know, maybe they're measured or comped on leads. And then an organization is like, what do I do with these leads? They're not converting. into real revenue. That, you know, the sales team or the customer team is not able to convert those leads into something that drives revenue. So then maybe there's an opportunity then to partner with leadership to figure out, is marketing being incentivized in the right way to drive the right sort of benefits for the organization? Yeah. That's where this starts to get really interesting.
So this is more on the revenue side, right? And I'm glad that now you have your own company. So you have a better understanding on the other side when it comes to fundraising, debt, and cash, right? Because sometimes when you get into traditional FP&A, you are often just focused on the P&L, on the EBITDA. And you don't necessarily think about the balance sheet. Okay, what does it mean? You have debt covenant. You can only borrow so much.
These are the hard-hitting questions. I love these. Sorry.
Thank you. But can you speak a little bit about how do you transition to stretch your thinking beyond just the P&L? Because really every decision a business makes is a capital allocation. Like I'm spending cash on this or I'm spending cash on that, and I have to stay within the guardrails of my covenants.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. I'll take a big step back or a big, 30,000 foot view of this. But before we can even get into P&Ls versus balance sheet, it goes back to when we talked about with marketing. It's like, what are the goals of the organization? And I think as a finance person, I've fallen into the trap in the past where my CEO showed up at my desk and was like, hey, we need a plan. And I'm like, okay, what kind of plan? Yeah, we need a plan for next year. So can you put one together and I'll take a look at it? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I can put a plan together. What do you want to do with the company? So step one is, and believe it or not, a lot of organizations, sometimes finance has to drive those strategic planning sessions. And sometimes the best finance leaders and the ones who really become the chief operating officers of an organization are driving those strategic planning sessions. And the way I love to do this is to make everything a cycle or make everything scheduled. Because my catchphrase for the year, one of my New Year's resolutions was, what gets scheduled gets done. And so you can think about, you can think about a planning calendar. So, you know, in the beginning, you know, maybe 3 months prior to the beginning of the fiscal year, you're going with your executive team over what are the strategic goals of the organization. You use those and those KPIs you've already put together to say for each department or team, what are my top three KPIs? You use that to build a plan. But then comes to your actual question, which is like, where does the balance sheet come into this? The reality is, depending on whether you are a profitable organization looking to meet the capital constraints that you have. Well, all businesses have capital constraints in theory. Whether you're looking to meet the financial constraints, or if you're some of our venture-backed listeners, it's a runway question of how much burn do you have that you want to allocate for a period of time. But you have two things that you have to look at. You have the business strategic goals, and then you have your financial goals. And typically, that's a conversation with the CEO. Again, you can make recommendations of how long do you want, if you're a cash burning organization, how long do you want the runway to stretch out for? Maybe it's indefinite, or maybe it's we want it to last the next 36 months. If you're a profitable organization, you have a certain amount of cash flow that you can dip into, like what sort of reserves are we looking for? What's our appetite for taking risk? How much debt do we want to use? Those are constraints that you then use to plug into your plan to back up against the strategic and financial goals and blend them together to do a little bit of iterative work to make them match as closely as possible. This, by the way, is the part that breaks everyone in the budget cycle, is like these two things do not match ever. And so that's when we go back to the people part of setting a schedule for building a financial planning process of, okay, great. We started three months before the end of the year. We have the strategic plan. We have our financial goals. Finance oftentimes puts together a first pass. It's usually top down, bottoms up, and a bottoms up of how to make these numbers work. Top down says it makes sense. Bottoms up says it's impossible. Now we start fighting the good fight and we start meeting with each of the different leaders to say like, hey, I'm not going to be able to grant you all of your headcount wishes next year because we've got a gap to make up. Go back. Let's get creative is my favorite term. Yes. Let's get creative with this amount of resources and tell me how you'd get this done. And then that's when finance can really start leaning into its leadership role. And instead of saying, you can't have this, or you can't have do this, or you can't do this, you can start really co-creating with your business partners on how to make something happen.
Love it. And now back into your CFO days, because this, you can tell you were CFO for a long time, right? Because a lot of technology, people in technology didn't necessarily have the finance background you have. Right. And I want to speak a little bit now with the uncertainty in the economy, in just the world right now. What are some things that we as finance leaders should really pay attention to? You spoke a little bit about reserves. You spoke a little bit about constraints. Like what are some things we should just be mindful of, right? We think AI is disrupting this, supply chain being disrupted, industries flipped upside down. What would you say are some things that finance leaders, CFOs today should really pay attention to or get ready for?
I will say it in one word, and that is speed. And the reason why speed is so important, it goes back to the example of we're not perfect forecasters. We can't predict the world. We would be buying stocks and in Vegas, et cetera. Like no one can predict what's going to happen. But the ability to adapt to that change and to plan quickly and to make adjustments and to be prepared is the by far the most important thing. So think of back to the early days of COVID or when the world sort of, when the asset class of venture capital blew up post 2021, all these unexpected events, and we've lived through so many black swan events through the last 10 years, we know that the world is more volatile than ever. Yes. And it goes back to the old saying about evolution, which is it's not the, not the smartest or strongest that survives. It's the one that's most adaptive to change. And so as finance professionals, we have to think of ourselves as the ultimate in sort of driving the evolution of our organizations. And that means that when something inevitably happens, we have to be prepared for it. So that's two things. Number one, we have to have a plan for that. It's no longer okay to have a plan A or even a plan A and a plan B. We have to have a plan C and a plan D. And that's when having these really good planning cycles and thinking ahead allows us to, when the inevitable happens, something dips in a not good way, something accelerates in a great way. We know we have a plan for that and we know how to adapt to it. Having really great business tracking and reporting allows us to see when those changes are about to happen so we can execute on that plan. And knowing how to execute on that plan is speed. So speed and preparedness by having lots of different, let's call it sensitivity or scenario planning, allow us to move faster and to stay ahead of the pace of business. That's where finance really has a superpower in this highly volatile era.
Love it. And then speed, going back to what you said earlier about people, process, and systems, how do you build that ability for speed and preparedness in your people, in your processes, and in your systems?
I go back to the most simple, I'm a big fan of simplicity. So I could, again, talk to you about finance transformations and all these ways to do it with software, but I always start with people first. And it starts with, does everyone know what they're supposed to be doing as it relates to the finance process? So, you know, do the budget owners know who they are? Do they know what their role is? Do they know when they're expected to do things? Do they know what the expectations are? Do they have a rules of engagement? This is actually a very important one. If you've ever rolled out a budget cycle, or a plan, or done budget versus actuals, and they've had a million questions, and they ask the same questions over and over and over again, like, can I roll this budget over to next quarter, et cetera? I want to trade this one headcount for three. Can I do that? But they're not thinking about overhead or space, et cetera. I always like to start with my budget owners and my business with rules of engagement. Here's how we operate as a finance function. Here are definitions of things. Here's what matters to us as an organization. And here's the calendar of what you can expect from us throughout the year. So that no one is like, what do you mean I was supposed to get you that last week? It's on the calendar. You got the reminders, et cetera. So I like to set up everything in place so that we can move with speed when it's time. As opposed to just like anything else in life, being reactive, it's about being proactive.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Love it. This was so good. I have two last questions for you, but we definitely need to do a part two. So, yes. So what's the best career advice you've ever received?
I did a post about this one. I met a CFO at an IPO conference, and I was more junior in my career. And, you know, at the time, there weren't as many women in the room. And I just really looked up to her and her career. And I invited her to lunch, and we sat down, and she started talking to me all about sales. And I was like, what? Like, I thought we were going to talk about finance. You're a CFO. And she said, no, Christina, finance is all about sales. And I also learned, now that I'm a CEO, everything is about sales. And hear me out, because I know finance and sales, oftentimes we're like, what do we have in common with one another? But sales is actually about just understanding where the other person is coming from and tailoring your communication and messaging and process to what becomes a win-win between the both of you. And where that applies in finance specifically is that example we just talked about setting a proactive finance organization, working with your business partners. It's about hearing them and selling these ideas to them. Coming into the room and saying, no, you can't spend money is very different than saying, here are the constraints we're working with. I'd love to help you figure out how to make this work. Let's talk about some options. And maybe you come with some things in your back pocket. Maybe there's a way that you, when you do have a little extra to allocate, you send it their way. So it's a way of building relationships, but at the end of the day, it is about selling. It's not just saying, and by the way, I've been this person before because I came from large organizations where finance ruled all, and it's like, finance asks for something, you got to send it, is making finance more of a partner, and that's by learning how to sell. And selling is not just about saying, would you like to buy this pen? And that old sell me this pen conversation, it's actually about, what are you looking to do in your job? And turns out that they need to sign a paper, to sign a very big deal that's going to close at the end of the month. They really need a pen. And what if I told you I could get this to you in the next 5 minutes? So How do you work with the teams in your organization to make their lives better? That's what sales is really all about.
Love it. Yeah, we all in sales. And I learned it a bit late. I'm glad you learned it earlier than I did. So my last question, what do you like to do outside of work? Because being a CEO, I don't know how much time you have left, but
I'm a mom of two. I have 2 9-year-olds, so I have twins. So I spend most of my time with my family. And I will say, I know this isn't as exciting, but have you ever heard of the 4-burner theory?
No. Mm-mm.
So the idea is you have 4 burners on your stove, and there's health, family, work, and recreation. And if you want to be really good at anything, you have to turn one of the burners off. A lot of listeners are not going to like this. No, we can do all this. You can. If you want to be great at anything, the idea is you have to turn a couple of the burners off. For me, the 2 burners that I turned off were recreation. And I do try and be healthy. But really, I spend most of my time either with work or family, and that really fulfills me. So that's where I spend most of my time. Also, I am extremely organized, and I love just organizing my home. I mean, maybe that goes with a finance thing, but I call that a hobby. Spending a lot of time at the Container Store these days, yes.
Oh, that is so funny you said that, because that's my fight with my husband. I very organized at work, and then you go look at my closet, you're like, whoa, what's the So that didn't translate well for me. But thank you so much, Christina, for being on the show. This was super helpful.
Thank you. It was so fun.
And that's it for today's episode of The Diary of a CFO. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like, review, subscribe, and share with others. Our website is thediaryofacfo.com. That's where you can find all the episodes, access all the guest profiles, see their bios, and the social media links. It is also the place where you can apply to be a guest on the podcast and have information about how you can sponsor the show. As always, if there is any topic you would like me to cover in the future, just email me at ask@thediaryofacfo.com. Again, the email is ask@thediaryofacfo.com. See you soon.